Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. The COVID-19 pandemic has changed our lives in many, many ways. We're encouraged to wear masks in public, to practice social distancing of at least 6 feet, not to congregate in large groups, and to work from home as much as possible. It could also have a major impact on the way that candidates for office seek votes from members of the public. It's very unlikely these candidates will campaign door-to-door this summer and fall, and it's unlikely that they'll be shaking hands at events like farmers markets and county fairs. So what will these candidates do to help get their message out to voters, especially the candidates who are not well-known and may be running for office for the first time? Today in the program, we're going to explore these questions with a great panel. With us today, Matt Dickinson, who's a political science professor at Middlebury College. Matt, great to have you on the program.
Great to be with you, Bob.
And also with us, Elizabeth Hewitt, a longtime reporter for VT Digger. Elizabeth, great to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
And a little later in the program, we'll be joined by Washington Post reporter David Weigel. Matt, let's start with you. Do you think we're entering a new world of campaigning and electing public officials during this pandemic?
I do. I think we saw evidence of that today with Phil Scott announcing that he will be running for re-election as governor, and yet he won't be campaigning, at least not in the traditional sense, under the current circumstances. This is unprecedented, and it raises the question, for instance, if you're a challenger, how can you take the measure of the incumbent candidate if you can't be on the same stage with him, if you can't interact with him in the way that you would under a traditional campaign, to say nothing of the issues that you raised, the lack of personal retail contact between candidates and voters. So, yeah, I think this is an undiscovered country.
So, Matt, when the governor says he's going to be a candidate for re-election, but he's not going to campaign, do you think that after Labor Day, after the primary, things would be different, or do you think this is kind of the stance that he's going to take?
Well, I think it, as the incumbent who is in front of the public almost every day in the context of the coronavirus, he has the best of both worlds. He gets free media coverage but doesn't have to sink down to the level to appear to be campaigning, which he, you know, has expressed a distaste for. You know, he's in a position where he's the one who declares whether when the emergency is over. So there's certainly conflicting interests here. It's hard to read what the future will bring. But certainly leading into the August primary, and again, he has a challenger, although people aren't aware of this, it's just hard to see how any challenger is going to get traction. What happens in the general election, I think, largely determines on whether we're still under coronavirus restrictions.
And Elizabeth, what are your thoughts overall? Are we entering a sort of a new era of campaigning?
Yeah, I think so. You know, a lot of Vermonters are very familiar with a lot of in-person campaigning, seeing folks at the farmers markets. A lot of legislative candidates will sort of make it a point of pride to hit most of the doors in their district and just go and have that face-to-face time with people. You know, greeting people at fairs, that's a long standing Vermont tradition, and of course fairs are canceled this summer by order of the governor, and so a lot of these in-person interactions that we're really used to, where candidates can have that opportunity to have the personal face-to-face interaction, won't be there. And you know, there's also it extends beyond that. How comfortable will people be getting a flyer stuck in their door, even if they're not actually seeing another person? You know, right now people are really conscious of the surfaces that they're touching. And for most candidates, I think this is kind of you're in new territory. It's a different strategy to be approaching. So already we're starting to see a lot of events held by Zoom, you know, more social media strategy, certainly. But then the other thing is that, you know, I think for a lot of folks, there might be some unease about a traditional campaign right now, right? It might feel a little bit tone deaf to be out there putting out fundraising messages. As we, you know, the governor has said that he won't be sort of doing the traditional campaigning and fundraising. at least in the beginning. So it definitely will be new territory.
And Elizabeth, as Matt mentioned, I think the governor is going to have two primary challenges when the deadline is all said and done. We certainly have lots of people running for other statewide offices. The primaries are going to be quite crowded. At the same time, as you mentioned, Elizabeth, is a little tone deaf for candidates to be out there campaigning in the traditional way. This makes things pretty difficult for these challenging candidates, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it does. I suspect in the months ahead, we'll start to see messages emerge in the coronavirus age. You know, so far we've seen really quite remarkable lack of partisanship in a lot of the way that state officials have responded to this. We've really seen legislative leaders have kind of been in lockstep with the governor on a lot of points, beginning to see some splintering around issues like mail-in voting. But now that we're getting to the point of setting, you know, figuring out what we're going to do with this $1.25 billion, where you're really seeing sort of there's political ideologies, right, that come into factoring how to go about this. Governor Phil Scott, of course, big affordability guy, and we're already starting to see him use that message occasionally when he's at the podium. The ways that politicians of different parties respond from here, I think those will be more of what we see as political divisions and ways and the messages that folks are putting out, as opposed to sort of the issues that we might have seen if this outbreak had not happened, things like marijuana legalization that have come up in previous campaigns a lot.
Well, at this moment, there are eight major party candidates seeking the office of lieutenant governor. That office is vacant because the incumbent, David Zuckerman, is one of three Democrats running for the party's gubernatorial nomination. Now, most of these candidates are developing an online video presence as part of their effort to connect with voters. Here's a sampling of what I found that they're doing.
Thank you all for coming. And I am Brenda Siegel. I'm a candidate for lieutenant governor in Vermont. And Medicare for All is an issue I have been working on for many years. I was a huge proponent of Act 48, which was basically a Medicare for All or a single payer system in Vermont.
Good evening. My name is Molly Gray. And from my living room to yours, welcome to tonight's COVID Relief Benefit Concert. I'm pleased to be able to introduce the incredible lineup of musicians hailing from across Vermont who have donated music and messages of hope for all of you this evening.
Hi, I'm Debbie Ingram. I'm a state senator from Chittenden County, and I am running for lieutenant governor of Vermont. There are 14 fabulous counties in Vermont, and this week we are going to Washington County in our virtual tour of the state. Join us.
Well, good evening. This is Tim Ash, president of the Vermont State Senate. It's Thursday, April 16th. I want to talk to you today about a series of updates as we continue to work our way through this public health and economic crisis. And I'm going to have a little bit of emphasis on both sides of the crisis ledger.
My name's Dana Colson. I'm from Sharon, Vermont. I grew up on a dairy farm. Where we did everything from milking cows to raising vegetables to logging. Graduated with a mechanical engineering degree from Vermont Tech and later with a business degree from Franklin Pierce.
My name is Meg Hansen, and I am running to be your next lieutenant governor. We don't need more activists in office. We need many more advocates of Vermonters. I am running to be your advocate.
Matt Dickinson, have we just seen the future of campaigning in Vermont?
Well, at least in the short term, I think it is the future. And there are two things that stand out. As somebody who late in life has migrated over to Zoom for all my teaching and necessity, it's not an easy medium to master. It's not simply a question of opening up a computer or turning on the software and speaking. There's an art to it, and you're going to see varying degrees of expertise as these individuals try to migrate to this new platform. The second thing is, in contrast to, you know, traditional over-the-air broadcasting and campaign ads on television or radio, which pretty much everybody can see, you have to opt in. You have to know that these candidates are running this stuff, you know, on social media, using Zoom messages and so forth. And that's that gets to the access issue here. Who has access to this? And one of the things we're going to be interested in as political scientists is whether there's a generational impact here with older generations who might be a little less comfortable with new technology, not having a more difficult time communicating with these candidates. So in the short term, everybody is trying to work out the best approach here for doing the traditional things that they used to have done by knocking on doors and advertising on radio and television.
And Elizabeth, do you think that this kind of Zoom technology for candidates, does it favor certain people who are more comfortable with this technology?
I suspect it does. You know, I also have wondered about the generational divide here. And, you know, just knowing that that younger folks might be more comfortable sort of getting out a social media campaign or, you know, hosting these different online Zoom events. I also wonder in Vermont how we'll see other platforms like Front Porch Forum that are a little bit less high tech, a little bit more accessible, that there might be other ways that things come up. Perhaps local newspapers will be more of a venue or radio as well.
It'd be fascinating to see how this all unfolds and how much campaigning actually happens with these different platforms. Let's talk to Stephanie, who is calling from Milton. Hi, Stephanie. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me. So this is a question for all of you. I know that Molly Gray is doing town halls that allow for landline access, and I was wondering how are other current candidates changing their campaign strategies to reach out to populations that only have access to a landline, like you said earlier, due to a lack of access or due to economic barriers, or they're just not used to it.
Stephanie, thanks for your phone call. Elizabeth, do you think a lot of candidates right now are trying to figure this out, exactly what Stephanie's question was? How do we communicate with voters?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I am not familiar with whether that telephone option has been available for other events that candidates have hosted. But I know that we did see actually early on with the congressional delegation in Vermont, there were a few phone calls that went out to sort of everybody in Vermont, I think, and a lot of people in Vermont who had the option to then pick up and join in. So I definitely think that we are seeing the ways that people can connect seem pretty dynamic right now. And there have been a lot of, just think about how things have changed for so many of us and the ways that we connect over the last 2 months. So I suspect that candidates, you know, have some room to be pretty innovative here as they figure it out. But yeah, it's got to be a pretty daunting thing when you know that you can't go out to, you know, your 4th of July parade and have that be an opportunity to get stickers out and get your message out.
And Matt, that has got to be, I imagine, for a lot of campaign offices right now, really scratching their heads, wondering, given the dynamics of the virus and the lack of person-to-person contact, how are we going to cope with this thing? How are we going to get our message out, especially for those candidates who are not particularly well-known?
I think that's exactly right. We know that the marginal impact of every additional dollar spent on advertising is much more important for challengers than it is for incumbents, for most incumbents, because the incumbents have the name recognition. And the challenger are desperately craving just to get that name out there. And you raise an important issue, too. In the era of coronavirus, the difficulty many challengers have is, and I'm thinking in particular here, if I'm challenging Governor Scott, you know, you don't want to attack somebody for their handling of a health crisis, for instance. You want to pivot to issues in which, and Elizabeth alluded to a couple of these, you know, the marijuana legalization or something, or the, you know, higher the parental leave issue. At the same time, you're very cognizant of the fact that people's lives have been turned upside down by this health epidemic. And so not only is it the technology they're struggling with, it's the framing of the campaign message and the degree to which you both acknowledge that this isn't politics as normal, and yet if you're going to defeat the incumbent, you need to approach this as if it's politics as normal. You have to have a message, and you have to be able to criticize the incumbents.
Let's talk to Ann in Bradford. Hi, Ann. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I moved here from Oregon, and I want to put a plug in for how Oregon has the paper system. Now, they have a they mail out the forms, and you fill them out, you sign them, and then you mail them back. But with it, they have voters' pamphlets where they give the information you want. So anybody that's running for office could or should, you know, put some information in so you're informed, and you can mail it back. Another thing they do is they have boxes set up in the stores nearby so you can actually walk and cast your ballot that way. And it's spread out over probably a month or so. So you can, you know, have plenty of time to study the issues and get it on.
All right, Ann, thanks very much for your comment. Elizabeth, we see this issue unfolding in the Vermont legislature, maybe this week, maybe next week, the whole idea of having vote by mail in November, something that Secretary of State Jim Condos would like to do. He's in a disagreement with Governor Scott. The governor wants to wait until after the primary and then have a special commission take a look at the idea and allow the state to opt out of having vote by mail. There's going to be a spirited debate in the legislature about this issue. Do you think we're inevitably headed towards vote by mail because a lot of folks don't want to go to the polling place in November?
You know, I don't know if we're definitely headed in that direction. It seems like the governor had been initially sort of reluctant on this point, sort of saying let's not make a decision now that would definitely set the landscape for where we will be and how this process will play out in November. And you know, it's very hard to predict what things will look like so many months out, obviously. But yeah, it seems like there's definitely a lot of will in the legislature to move in this direction. And like I mentioned earlier, this has sort of emerged as one of the first really political fights of the coronavirus crisis in Vermont. We're not alone. This is happening. There's discussions about this happening all over the country. Just this week, the governor, on Wednesday, raised concerns about, he sort of pointed to the legislature as making this a partisan issue. So it certainly seems like there's likely to continue to be spirited discussion around this.
Matt, I want to go back to something you mentioned just before we braked, and that is how difficult it is for a statewide candidate perhaps to run against Governor Scott with the pandemic crisis going on. In some ways, it may be hard to tell. Here we are at the end of May, and as we've learned, a lot can happen in the course of just 1 week. But if you were looking ahead to the November election, do you think it becomes a referendum on Governor Scott's leadership during the pandemic, or will other issues, as Elizabeth was mentioning, be it health care or legalization of marijuana, school funding, do you think we'll see those issues also returning to the table?
Well, one of the interesting dynamics in an election is how the candidates frame what the election is about. And the difficulty I think both sides are going to have here is trying to modulate a message that acknowledges that in some respects the coronavirus is above politics. It affects everybody regardless of political affiliation. And yet, on the other hand, you want to make the case for why you should be the individual sitting in that governor's chair moving forward. You know, one of the problems I think Governor Scott has here is, yes, I'm going to run on my handling of the coronavirus, and I've been out there almost every day and holding these press conferences. But so much of the outcome of it is out of my hands, you know, and it's, we don't know how the public is reacting to this. Are they praising him for keeping the death total down, or is he getting criticism for the economic hardship that's been inflicted? These are issues that aren't traditionally issues that a candidate and an incumbent has to deal with. 3 months ago, we thought the economy was Phil Scott's strong suit. Now it may be an Achilles heel. How much does he get blamed for it? How much do people recognize the impact of the coronavirus? And again, we're in May. As you correctly point out, we don't know how this is going to unfold. Is there going to be a second wave of the coronavirus in the fall, or is it just going to sort of gradually, you know, diminish in severity? These are a lot of difficult and, in some respects, unpredictable factors that are going to loom large to voters' calculations.
Let's go back to our listeners and talk to Roger, who is calling from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Roger. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me on. It's a very good program, and I can jump right to the issue I have. I'm probably older than most people listening to this program. I remember the 30s when FDR was critical on the radio. The reason I say that is the way we communicate, the way politicians communicate to the public, is far more important than people realize, because the computer and the internet have really changed how people behave. People don't go to mass meetings as much as they used to. The telephone started it, then there was the radio, but the computer combined with all everything else means that we do things more as individuals, and it's really changed politics. And I'm not going to say how that works for one people or another, just to say that there are many things that aren't about at all, primarily about the particular problem like COVID, but about the way we behave in terms of things we can't control and have to adapt to. And I think the big thing is to adapt to the computerized world. Because, just to finish this, one of the big divisions in America are between the people who do and don't use computers. And the people who don't use computers, they think that there's a whole political movement, that there's a dark state that's planning against them and so forth. They feel left out and not taken seriously. And it's because there is this class and economic difference connected with education, but also connected with cities, just a lot of things connected, that even within cities there are huge differences. Mm-hmm. So I throw out this lecture, and I don't have any exam in my lecture, but professors are like that. I'm glad you gave me a chance to just discuss this, because it has no immediate solution, but we've got to think about that. And thank you on the radio for what you do to let individuals say something.
All right, Roger, we appreciate your phone call very much. Let's talk to Dina, who is calling from Corinth. Hi, Dina. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Well, first of all, that other speaker is older than I am, but I'm 78, and I did a Zoom for the Windsor County Democrats when all the candidates for lieutenant governor were on, and it was wonderful. They were all terrific. Now I certainly don't know who to vote for, because they're all terrific. And you see their face close up, and wonderful questions were asked. So it's, you know, I don't need to shake hands with somebody at the Tunbridge Fair.
All right, Dina, thank you very much for your comment. Matt Dickinson, we've been saying that, you know, maybe, and we've gotten a couple of emails about this, that that this 2020 campaign and having the coronavirus with less personal interaction means that candidates with good name recognition are going to be in far better shape than those that are first-time candidates. But taking the other side of this discussion, as Dina was mentioning, if we do all of a sudden have a lot of forums, be it the county forums or other organizations holding these different debates and candidate availabilities, does it give some of the lesser known candidates a little bit of visibility that they might not have had before?
Well, I think the advantage, if you're a lesser name candidate, and this is a great point Dina raised, is that it's cheap. You can get your name out there, or parties can hold these types of town hall meetings on the cheap. It doesn't cost nearly as much as it would to buy advertising done over the air or television. So, yeah, there is that advantage. And certainly all the candidates will, you know, try to maximize their use of what is really a low-tech, in the sense of cost, medium. The worry, I think, is who's viewing it on the other side. That's the difference. Roger talked about sort of the class differences, the digital divide that has been a longstanding concern in Vermont. Just when you think, for instance, about and Elizabeth's probably covered a lot of this, the issue of schooling and who has access to online teaching resources and who doesn't. That's the concern, I think, if you're going to try these Zoom platforms and these town halls. The activists who are looking for this are maybe able to tune in, but is Joe and Jane Yeoman Farmer going to be able to do this? I'm not so sure.
And Elizabeth, you alluded to this a little earlier. Right now, there seems to be a lot of bipartisan spirit going on between the legislature and the governor. There's a lot of money at stake. We're talking about $1.2 billion that is going to be spent to help prop up the state budget and state economy. Does the rubber hit the road in the fall when lawmakers, I'm pretty sure, will be still in session, probably in a video form still, where they have to start making some pretty tough budget decisions, and the governor indicating that he is not going to be supporting an increase in revenue, and that might mean reducing or cutting some really critical programs? Is that where we might see some debate between the Republicans and the Democrats?
Yeah, I think absolutely. One area in particular that we're likely to see a lot of clashing is in education, because the education fund is in tough shape, and you know there's so many questions around schooling and how things are happening there. And already that was a point of considerable contention between between the governor and the legislature. I definitely think that will be one of the big flashpoints here. I think another potential vulnerability for Governor Phil Scott, less with the legislature, but more broadly, will be sort of the fatigue around some of these measures. Already there's some sort of feeling among some Vermonters, I think, who are, say, our case numbers are really low at this point. Things seem pretty safe. We keep talking about how well we've done with this, so why can't I open up my business and operate as usual? And I think that going into, depending on how long all of this plays out over the next few months, I think that could become a point that could be tough for the governor.
Today on the program, we're discussing how the coronavirus pandemic might be affecting candidates as they campaign for office this summer and fall. It does seem like door-to-door campaigning is going to be a thing of the past, and maybe holding neighborhood rallies might also be difficult. So how do candidates get their message out to voters, and how do voters learn about the various candidates? With us today to discuss this, Elizabeth Hewitt, who is a reporter at VT Digger, also Matt Dickinson, a political science professor at Middlebury College, and joining us right now is David Weigel, who covers politics for The Washington Post, and is also the author of a newsletter called The Trailer, which is a fascinating look at political issues. David, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's good to be here. Thank you.
David, in one of your recent newsletters, you addressed the whole issue of the difficulty of challenging an incumbent politician during this COVID-19 pandemic. What are some of the factors that you find that make it so hard?
Well, some of them are just grassroots factors, is the fact that people were building campaign operations that were going to overwhelm the incumbent, put people on the streets, have them knock on doors, and they can't do that anymore because try to walk around and knock on people's doors at the moment. So that's one structural problem. The other one that people have encountered more recently is that the argument of an insurgent candidate is obviously this person needs to be replaced because they're not doing a good job. And you've actually seen kind of little remarked upon ticks up in public support, not for the president, but for a lot of members of Congress, for governors. You've seen this for governors, but I think it's underappreciated that most Democratic voters especially have an enormously high favorable rating toward Nancy Pelosi. They're satisfied with Joe Biden. They're satisfied with their local member of Congress. And for there to be a wave of an incumbent upset, you really need more anger out there at the people in power. A lot of this goes back to the CARES Act. I mean, the fact that that basically everybody who's being challenged in primary voted for it, and that it's been so far pretty popular, I think matters. And you can look at Bernie Sanders' role in touting the bill, you know, criticizing the early version of it, promoting the later version of it. There's just really not much of a mode for resistance against that, and it's been hurting the people who got into this cycle saying, let's get the people to kick the incumbents out.
David, might this situation change, though, as Congress considers yet another stimulus package? I think the House recently gave its approval to, it's called the HEROES Act. I think it's about a $3 trillion stimulus package. It sounds like over in the Republican-controlled Senate, there's less enthusiasm for that particular package. Is this where things could start to fall apart?
Yeah. Well, if I fall apart, it's a big question, because what the Democrats do with the HEROES Act is lay a marker for what they're going to want. If there's another stimulus package, it's unclear if one would pass at all. One thing that could happen is the Senate passes a bill, they go to conference. The Democrats have a couple of asks in here that, in terms of what motivates their voters, are a lot more about election security than about this or that new stimulus plan. I mean, they, for example, didn't include something that a lot of people on the left wanted, which was a basic income as long as the crisis lasts. They don't have that in it. But that right now is not really a subject of much attention. Just have the mood of the country at the moment is in the get back to normal mood. And that's something that just a few months earlier really hurt Bernie Sanders. I mean, he was looking for a groundswell of voters who wanted to overthrow the establishment. A lot of voters answered that with, well, we already overthrew one establishment and I'm nervous all the time, so let's just get back to something more calm. And it's weird. I don't want to be in the position as a journalist saying, here's why we need these to keep things as they are. That's not it. It's just that there's not the same interest by voters in overthrowing at least the crisis response system in Washington right now. Now, could that change in a couple months? It could, but look at the timing of these primaries. I mean, most of the primaries might be over if these policies become popular by August.
And Matt Dickinson, as David mentioned, there's this feeling of let's return to normal. It's a very different feeling than it was in 2016. If we looked at the Republican presidential primary and the Democratic presidential primary, where there was really a challenge to the status quo in both parties, 4 years later, it seems totally different.
It is. When you talk to voters, and as I was hanging out at these rallies, one thing that becomes clear is, as David points out, 2016 was to take a flyer on the anti-establishment or non-establishment candidates. Now, particularly among Democrats, the priority is not sort of moving the party left progressive policies. It's defeating Donald Trump, and what candidate is the safest choice to do that? And that's a large part of why Joe Biden ended up being the nominee, despite the fact that he is, in many ways, not the future of the Democratic Party. The other issue here, though, and I think you alluded to this earlier, Bob, is, you know, the coronavirus right now makes it very difficult to run against an incumbent without appearing to be callous to the impact of this virus on people's lives. And so, as a challenger, you need to modulate your message in a way that says, you know, I understand that our leaders are in difficult positions and they're doing their best, but we still have the right to criticize their handling of this this particular disease. And I think that's going to be the interesting fact as we move forward into the general election, how they go about doing that.
And Elizabeth, I wonder if Vermont voters are feeling, let's just get back to normal, as David suggested, that's going to be the focus for many voters. And if you're a competing gubernatorial campaign, how do you break through that? Do you think people even want to listen to a different message, or is the desire to get back to normal just the overarching issue for many people?
I think that is the overarching interest. You know, I don't know that a whole lot of people are going to be very interested in elections right now. I think there's a lot of fatigue, and, you know, there are a lot of issues that are much more prominent on people's minds than what's going to happen in November. And I think that will be the challenge for these challengers against incumbents in the governor's race and in general, of how do you sort of reach those people and what message can you bring that might excite people and might, you know, try to get people out to the polls even.
David, in another one of your newsletters, you look at the issue of voting by mail and how it's become mm-hmm. a highly partisan issue down in Washington. We're starting to see that emerge in Vermont. 30 states, I think, in your newsletter, at least 30 states, if not more, have some kind of early voting system where a voter can get a ballot for any reason. Vermont actually has the most lenient early voting law in the country. Voters can request a ballot within 45 days of an election for any reason whatsoever. I think 5 states have voting by mail already. Why has this issue become so partisan?
Well, it's been become partisan in a kind of lumpy fashion. So the president's word on this, which is that a vote by mail is amenable to more fraud than normal voting, that's not something that has been put into legislative action in a lot of states. I mean, it's really – we're down to only 6 states, all in the deep south. And Texas is the only one that parties are really competing for in November. Only 6 states where you can't request an absentee ballot without some sort of medical excuse unless you're 65 or older. Everywhere else has been relaxing these laws, but the caveat that there was more momentum to just relax them, just fix this problem, sort it out quickly before the president started speaking. That did harden some partisan opposition. And look, not everything is about what legislators do. The Republican Party, through the RNC, is at the same time suing in a lot of states to try to limit some of the expansions they've done already. And their position, if you ask them, is they just want states to follow the law, which they've succeeded at in Wisconsin. They're suing in California. The implication of that is states that were reacting to the emergency by making it easier to vote, we want them to go back to the rules they had before there was a pandemic, before there was a crisis, assuming no crisis. And the action's really going to be more in courts, looking for – you can see it in the briefs, kind of looking for stories of, you know, some mailboxes being opened with ballots missing on the floor, just anecdotal evidence of that there can be some problems with mail voting to make a legal case that you need to get rid of it. But I would look more towards lawsuits, frankly, even though they're not as always as fun to read as the stuff we write. Look to that more than – the actions of governors. In many cases, Republican governors are fully in for making voting easier, and it's going to be Republican legal groups that go around them to try to sue and unwind the law.
Well, David, you mentioned fraud. We've gotten a couple of emails today during the program wondering, is there any evidence of fraud in those 4 or 5 states that currently allow voting by mail? From your research, have you been able to find much fraud?
Well, so it's an interesting way to put the question because there no system is fallible. I mean, I put my money in a bank. I'm aware that banks get robbed sometimes. Mine usually doesn't and is insured. And so there are states, mostly in the West Coast, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, Colorado, and Utah. There are states that only do vote by mail at this point. And what they'll tell you, and by they I mean there are three of the secretaries of state in those states are Republican. They'll tell you that they had to do it over a number of years. They have some safeguards. They send ballots to everybody who's registered to vote, and they've encountered usually per cycle maybe a couple hundred cases where a ballot's at least curious. Something might, you know, somebody might have tried something, filled in someone else's ballot. They have a method of chasing that just by calling them, trying to get the person to prove their identity. I mean, so they're. The thing that makes this all surreal is that we've had in the laboratories of democracy states that show how this can work, how it's expensive, but how you can pull it off and minimize fraud. And so the argument in these conservative legal briefs is is both, one, you can't do that. Not every state can turn itself into Oregon overnight and put these safeguards in. And two, just like I was saying before, emphasizing cases where fraud might have happened. And one thing I would say, if you're a reader of these stories, of these lawsuits, want to take a careful look at it, is you'll often hear a reference to ballots being misprinted lumped in with voter fraud. And that's not what voter fraud is. There's a story, for example, in South Carolina that the company they used for the ballots being distributed had forgotten to mail some. Okay, well, that meant that there are people whose votes might have been suppressed. That's not the same thing as fraud. That's the kind of problem that you can have with a voting machine. You know, the ideal voting machine with a paper trail you walk in, there's nothing preventing that from being, a failure to reset before election day. There's numerous problems that happen with every election. And so the struggle in this debate is separating the problems that can happen with absentee voting, all of which have been kind of vetted and tested and in some cases mitigated, separating that from the horror stories that make you think, boy, if I send my ballot in the mail, it's going to be in the fraud pile somehow. That's not actually how this works, and it's just look at the case studies. It's pretty clear that it's not wildly unsafe. It's got some kinks that don't exist with in-person voting, but in a pandemic where in-person voting might lead to, you know, very few polling places, people unwilling to vote, if you contrast it with that, it's night and day.
And we should mention that in the event that Vermont does go to voting by mail for the November election, voters would still have the opportunity to go down to their local polling place and vote in person if they wanted to. That option is always available. It's just a matter of all the ballots being sent out to registered voters, and then people can decide if they want to send them back in, bring them back in, vote in person. That's a decision that they can make. Let's go back to our callers and talk to Sue, who is calling from Woodstock. Hi, Sue. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment and say that I really wish that Phil Scott had taken the tax and regulate system for cannabis more seriously, because I feel that if he had and we had something at least going or in mind, we might have a little bit more of a cushion when it comes to money that we are really needing for a lot of things now. And I also wanted to just mention that I keep hearing the refrain of everybody saying, oh, we want to get back to normal. But I think that we really need to take a step back and think about how we're going to move ahead with more improved systems in place. Instead of thinking back to normal, I want to think with a mind towards the future and just really hoping to prevent some of the things that we've come to know that are actually issues in our state. So I just wanted to comment that, and I think that that'll definitely be on a lot of people's minds during voting this year.
Sue, thanks very much for your comment. Elizabeth, do you have any sense if lawmakers want to delve into things like tax and regulate and education reform and healthcare reform? Is that an area where you think they might want to go this fall, or is it going to be off bounds?
You know, there has been some indication from legislative leaders that they're interested in revisiting some of the priorities they had already been working on before the crisis began. One thing, the bill that would create a legal marijuana marketplace had passed both the House and the Senate and was headed to a conference committee, which is really sort of the final stretch before going to the governor's office. And that was happening sort of right in early March when everything derailed. And there has been some indication that legislative leaders might consider it. On the other hand, I think a lot of legislators are really reluctant to do anything that might tie up state money at a time when, you know, dollars are pretty short. While there would be some revenue eventually tied to a regulated cannabis system, it would take an investment to get set up. And I just don't know how much of an appetite there will be for that or how much cash there will be as lawmakers proceed later this year.
And David, as you look ahead for the next few months, do you have a sense that this presidential campaign is going to be a referendum on leadership in the pandemic, or will other issues emerge as important priorities?
Depending what you define issues as. So in terms of things that make people think about a choice between Trump and Biden more than a referendum on Trump, nothing's really stuck in the last few weeks. I mean, you can rattle off the scandals we've talked about. I mean, his "You Ain't Black" thing, the Senate trying to subpoena for Hunter Biden's records, the unmasking. It's a lot of stuff that's kind of splattered against the wall, at least for most voters. It's appealed, I think, and energized conservatives, but to win, you don't just need your conservatives. You need to get swing voters. When it comes to the actual policy, that's something the Democrats do want to focus on because they think there is a large opening among voters who took a chance with Trump but do not think that he I use this phrase because this is how the pollsters use it, doesn't care about people like them. You've seen already the Biden campaign try to emphasize more liberal policies, housing policies, public option for health care. They're pretty comfortable mm-hmm. having a policy choice argument. The Trump campaign, it's just less clear what we're going to do because they were really hoping, and I'm not saying they were right about this, they really were hoping to have a referendum with Bernie Sanders or they'd be running ads saying that they're going to replace all your health care with Medicare for All, you're going to be in breadline. Without that, with the image of Biden, they've not really found a issue that Democrats are on the wrong side of. The one exception I would say here is aspects of immigration. If you look at polling, for example, people were pretty comfortable with the president limiting immigration during the pandemic, pretty comfortable with the China travel ban. But that's not an overwhelming policy. I think that is just the one thing you've seen Trump be comfortable talking about that voters also agree with him on.
Well, we're out of time. It's been a great discussion of how campaign 2020 could be affected by the coronavirus pandemic. Many thanks to our panel, Elizabeth Hewitt, Matt Dickinson, and also David Weigel. We appreciate your participating very much. I'm Bob Kinzel. Thanks for listening and be safe.